Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Friday, May 16th, 2014. Good afternoon, Al.
Hello, Melody.
Oh, it's back to work, right?
It is for me.
Yes.
And so I guess it isn't a TGIF, huh?
Oh, no, it will always be that. It will always be that. It was a little TGIF for gold today. Gold was down $3.60 for $12.94. Silver was down 11 cents at $19.45. But both precious metals were off their lows of the day, along with platinum down 4 at $14.69, and palladium did manage to be to the positive, $8.19 up 4. The USDX today is trading pretty much unchanged, 80.04. Crude oil was up 55 cents today at 102.05. Paper markets today, let's see what they finished up. They had a little bit of a rebound today after the few hits that they took this week, and the S&P hit another record before it ended up pulling back sharply this week. So you have the S&P up 7 at 1877, the NASDAQ 21, 4,090, and the Dow up 45 at 16,492. And we're looking at the 10-year yield today at 2.52%, up 0.02. So markets really didn't do much today. They were down, they were up, and certainly ending the week on a quiet note. Little excitement earlier in the week with the markets down a couple hundred points. But when it's down a couple thousand points, then I'll get excited about it. But it certainly could set for a trend. And you talk to anybody, and everyone knows, Al, that the market is just barely breathing, and everyone is anticipating a significant decline. It's just a matter of when it's going to happen. So I think with those thoughts in mind, people should be at least pulling out their profits and preserving their wealth with them. Buy low,
yeah, but,
sell
you know,
high. Buy yep. low, sell high.
That's what it comes down to.
Absolutely.
And but people, that is what people should do. But what people do is follow the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And if the momentum is going up, that means it will continue to go up and then more up and up and up and up, and it will go up forever. So you can't lose by following momentum up, 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 and up. And You know, that's the problem. What we should do is buy low and sell high. What we do do is buy high and sell low. We buy because everybody else is buying, and then we sell because everybody else is selling. Exactly opposite of what you should do if you want to make any money in the markets. And yet that tends to be human nature.
And if you're fortunate enough, one is you buy low and sell low. That's what happens. Or sell lower. Buy low and sell lower.
It's one of the things that you actually, if you're going to get into investing, you have to do what's rational. And that's something you can perceive with your own eyes. And you can hear with your own ears. And you can understand on your own. Or you can do something irrational that feels good, nevertheless, and that is follow the herd.
And we're not going to follow the herd when we follow Wendy Wilson from the Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Wilson. Melanie. Hello, Al. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Great.
I understand we're going to talk about the new virtual gateway to healthcare.
Yeah, very interesting.
Technology or medicines or whatever in the works, and what do you think we should be aware of, and how soon will we be completely healed and guaranteed to live forever?
Well, yeah, that's the utopian idea. Well, the new healthcare gateway actually is being built as we speak, and they think it'll help transform the medical profession. So this is new cutting-edge technology that's being tested in the United Kingdom. And it's pretty much under development at the University of Sheffield and Sheffield Teaching Hospitals. So they're collaborating on this project, and what they're using is a computer-simulated interface, and the interface is really the human body. So they call the project Silico Virtual Physiological Human, or VPH for short. So according,
that's one of those names that you can practice that one for 5 or 10 minutes before you can say it correctly, but go ahead.
Yep. Well, according to the reports, Al, Melody, the new virtual medical program will not only streamline medicine treatments, but it'll also help with research and address some of the economic problems that tend to be associated with socialized healthcare. So we were delving into this thing to see what this approach is going to be. It's crossed the pond right now, but, you know, we may be seeing that live here in the U.S. So a lot of people say, well, what is it really? Well, the virtual physiological human interface is going to help physicians predict what patients' problems are going to have down the road, and they're going to offer real-time, time-saving approaches now for treatment plans. So the programs will have what is called specialty sections, which the interface will address things like cardio problems, pulmonary, neuromuscular, neurology, you know, the specialty areas of medicine. And each will have an assistant management plan for diseases. So if this computer software will, what it's going to do is run simulations of the human body and disease profiles. So the interface will offer a prediction for future health risks, and it also tends to predict, or they think it'll predict with the interface and remove any unnecessary steps or procedures like drugs, tests, and surgery, and streamline treatment plans, cut time and cost. So it's predicted the interface will significantly increase outpatient volume while decreasing inpatient volume. And it kind of sounds like this virtual program would be the perfect fix for socialized healthcare systems, which they've been researching this stuff since 2007, Al, and the cost right now for the UK is $220 million thus far, which would be equivalent to about $303 million US dollars. And the short-term plan is that they intend to roll this out in all countries in the EU in about 5 years. So
is this anything like reading palms or the bumps on your head, or how are they going to use this this computerized human interface.
Yeah, well, basically, this simulated interface will directly be used in clinical practices, supposedly to improve diagnosis and treatment. So my question when I was researching this was, will physicians be involved, or will this process be totally run by clinicians entering information and getting it spat back out to them from the computer? We don't know. One thing that I did learn while I was working in the medical field, training is kind of limited when you're out there in practices, in, you know, medical offices. And what they tend to do is throw a white lab coat on a medical secretary after she's gotten just brief instruction and call her a clinician. So I worry about that.
What's the difference between a clinician and an administrator?
Yeah. Not much.
A white coat? Is that the only difference? If you have a white coat, you're a clinician. Without the white coat, you're merely an administrator.
The reason
I ask that is because it does sound like this program could become administrative rather than diagnostic, if you catch my drift.
There's a point here
when you surrender your future, in a sense, to a machine.
Right. Well,
people don't have to make decisions. You just say, well, the machine said do it.
Right. And my question when I was reading this was, you know, will physicians be able to actually countermand what recommendations this interface, you know, puts forth? And the other problem is, you know, all technology is hackable. So
I understand that. And manipulable, if that's a word, or manipulatable, I guess.
Well, I did research where this interface is coming out of. The manufacturing of the guts of this silico human, if you will, Insignio Institute is the lead research facility manufacturing it. They're working with Sheffield University and Sheffield Hospital. But Insignio is really a leader in biomedical models. And for the last 5 years, they've been working on creating this digital patient human program, if you will. So the program's going to interface and perform personalized treatment plans for aged people, healthy people, active people, the whole shebang. Now, virtual physiological human interface is what they're calling it, is going to achieve not only the scientific data to help, you know, with predictions and treatment plans to streamline things, but it's also going to be calculating and collecting research, Al, and that research is going to translate, they're going to translate this program into all languages. So this tells me the interface will eventually be a global interface on many different levels. So it's going to be created to be used also in the education classroom setting. But here's where my eyeballs got real big. The interface is also intended to exploit the research results for commercial promotions and innovations and sold to companies to help with startups.
Well, you know, when we talk about this being a computer program, first question, is it voluntary or mandatory? And you can bet that it'll be voluntary initially, but the day will come that if you want government health care or you want any sort of government-paid health care, it's going to be mandatory. When the computer says do something, you got to do it. And if the computer says you can't do something, you got to stop doing it. That would be cause for enormous concern, because if you've decided that we have too many people on Social Security, all you've got to do is tweak the computer program to give senior citizens a bad diagnosis. The next thing you know, we're going to have an increased death rate, and we can shave a year or two off the life expectancy of people who are senior citizens in order to cut Social Security costs.
I think you're right. I think it's going to be a mandatory program, definitely for socialized health care, those countries that have it, and eventually, you know, this will be a global thing. But the thing I also see there, along with the ICD-9 CPT codes we talked about a while back, I see this program as also calculating your life value to determine how much is going to be spent on your health care in the future, predicting treatments and things like that. But here's the other thing that I found out was that the interface could take on the ability to think, Al. So we have to wrap our brains around the possibility that this interface will eventually develop into a virtual human that could be filled with artificial intelligence that would be literally in charge of your health.
Well, the next real question, one of the most intriguing questions for me is we start with this interface that allegedly can tell us what's going to happen to us physically. All right, they can deal with diseases. They can predict them. What about mental illness? How long before this interface is upgraded to where it not only predicts whether or not you're going to have cancer or stroke or hardening of the arteries, but it also predicts when you're going to become schizophrenic.
Or when you're checking out.
Well, the point is, this opens the door for a whole bunch of things if this advances. And you can bet there are people working on this right now.
Well, yeah.
They're doing physical here, and they're talking about it. And if they're not talking about doing mental, I guarantee they're thinking about it. And somebody's doing experiments right now to try to figure out how we can predict when somebody's going to flip out. And therefore, we can put them on drugs now, or maybe a little electroshock therapy, or perhaps a prefrontal lobotomy. And we can prevent these problems.
And this information is probably going to be, you know, collected, and it's going to be, you know, sent to insurance companies and you know, employment firms, law enforcement, Homeland Security. So definitely it's not going to be any secret. But here's something that I picked up on because Marco Vince Conti, he's Insignio's scientific director. He said the interface can stitch lots of information together. The sheer size, he says, is not a problem. And he says it's going to know in advance how a patient will respond to a particular treatment and can quantum leap the efficiency without inventing anything. And there's like 123 scientists and physicians that are contributing information to this virtual human program. For instance, Dr. Paul Morris, he's a British heart surgeon, he submitted work to help the interface create personalized virtual arteries of a patient's heart so that the interface can predict how successful heart surgery or a stent or a pacemaker would be on any given patient. So I'm sure that this program is going to be involved with approval or denial of treatment. So I think if it's going to work on statistics and algorithms, it's going to be a two-edged sword, because what if they're a mother-to-be and there's a problem with the baby and surgery may save the life of mom and baby, but then the computer says, no, the statistics say that it's probably going to be in vain, so we're just not going to approve that surgery. So how do you suppose someone's going to feel that a computer nixed the slight hope and miracle that could happen in saving a child, right?
I agree. I agree. There will be that's part of the big problem here. We'll be taking orders from a computer rather than, and I'm not, I mean, this sounds like a wonderful idea on the face of it. If they can actually improve the efficiency of medical device diagnosis and then medical device nursing, that's a great thing. It'll cut costs. We will reduce unnecessary surgery. But it's like anything else. It's like developing atomic power.
Well, it's the NSA.
Somebody's
going to
figure out quickly how to use this for the police state in the same sense someone figured out we'll use atomic power to destroy cities.
Well, Al, this is the NSA of medicine, if you think about it. And so Professor Peter Cubney, he's the director of science at the University College of London, he said this: obviously, this is the future of medicine, but the idea is for us to have a virtual avatar to predict how our real bodies will react to treatment. Will this avatar tell me when I'm going to die? End of quote.
Well, we're going to have an avatar. In other words, I would have one avatar for me, and you'd have another one for you, and Melody would have a third one, and so would each of us. That would be... No, that's what this implies, is we would carry our avatar around on some sort of a computer memory device that we keep with us or close at hand, or somebody's got it, and they can pull up the avatar for Addisk, and it tells how old he is and what's going on with his heart and his brain and the rest of that sort of thing, and it just keeps on adding and adding, and they have another one for you, another one for Melody. They'll start this as a child. You can bet that they'll start collecting your data as a child.
It's like Max Headroom, you know, and he's going to be spitting out everything about you and I and the whole world. I just think it's total insanity, to be honest.
I don't think it's total insanity, but it's a powerful technology, and inevitably it will be abused, and that's the world we're caught in. Brilliant technology inevitably allows people to abuse that technology, and it puts us in a quandary. Why don't you give folks some contact information, Wendy, and
Well, absolutely. I personally am going back to Eden. Forget the avatars. They could call the folks at Apothecary Herbs to learn how they can improve their health and remove toxins and boost immune systems. That's what we do. The toll-free number is 866-229-3663, 866-229-3663, or they can visit our website, thepowerherbs.com, thepowerherbs.com. Got to go, but thanks,
all
guys.
Right.
We'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Wendy. Talk to you next Thursday. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarson on Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Have a heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at www.thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs.
Actually, that tells me, Al, that from the time you're born, they will track so that they would have to have everything from the time of your birth.
They'll track more than that. They'll track your parents before you were born.
Yes.
Their genetics, they'll have genetic profiles. We're talking about the subject matter that Wendy brought up in the previous segment of the program, and how on the one hand it may be remarkable, and on the other hand it's extraordinarily dangerous, and we were kind of laughing about it when we... It's a little bit like when they shift over and start evaluating your mental capacity and your psychological profile, and they say, oh, this person's going into a depression, we'll need to give them some drugs right now to prevent the depression. This person's going into schizophrenia, we may have to do a little cutting, a little prefrontal lobotomy, it'll be for their own good. Once you get into it, it'll be like automobiles, where we have the recall, you know? The cars are recalled back to General Motors or Chrysler to have the brakes fixed or whatever when there was a defect. And even what we're seeing here, when you start thinking about an avatar for a person, that avatar will start perhaps at the moment of conception. When they first start doing the ultrasonic on in the womb, and we've got, and they start monitoring and monitoring the amniotic fluid and so on, it will start at least then. And it may start beforehand in terms of the parents. Virtual certainty that if they've got an outline on the, an avatar for each of the parents, it will be used to predict the avatar for the child. Now, once you do that, how long before this computer decides who can and can't have children? So, no, you two people can't have children because there will be a 42% probability that the child will develop one disease or another and cost society X number of dollars during his use, during his, during a normal lifespan. I mean, this really is the potential for horror that's associated with a program that on the face of it sounds like it would be a brilliant and beneficial technology for humanity.
But it's actually creating a perfect race.
That's what it reminds me of. What do they mean? They'll mean people who will automatically follow whatever orders come out of a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And who's programming the computer? I mean, the whole thing becomes just kind of, we have reached a point, again, as I said at the close of the first program, we have some brilliant technologies that are becoming increasingly apparent, and they seem delightful. And at the same time, they have the potential for fostering a police state, a society that is so bound up, it looks like Brave New World. I don't know how many of you have read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. It always impressed me more than 1984. I was, you know, both of the novels were available when I was back in high school. And I read 1984, which was, again, by... can't even think of it. I should be able to, and I can't. 1984, in any case, and I also read Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. 1984 was about a police state that was imposed on people primarily by thumping them on the head. And I've never thought that was a credible way to put people into bondage. But Brave New World showed how they could put people into bondage by providing extraordinary benefits. And the logic of doing good deeds could take you to an environment that no one wanted to live in. Just one thing after another, just this is good, then this is good, then this is good. And before you know it, you have something that's completely wicked. And that's where I think we're kind of in between both of those right now. We've got a certain amount of police state going around with a thump you on the head. We've got a certain amount of Brave New World from Aldous Huxley. Where they will entice you into bondage by means of providing superior medical care, free medical care, free food, who knows? Here, have a food stamp and be our slave. What else do we have, Melody?
I have this information here. It's an article, and it just struck me as bizarre. Did you ever play with Legos when you were a kid?
No, I think Legos didn't come out until later. I played with Erector sets. I had Erector sets back when I was a kid.
I don't know when Legos came out. But here's this company in California that actually rents Legos. Like you rent a car or Netflix where you... They did this last May. Wait till I get into the numbers. They did this last May. And because they do this because kids get so tired of playing with their toys.
Yep.
Now get this. There was a British study that said the average Western kid has 238 toys. It's like, but plays with only 12 on a daily basis. How many toys did you have when you were a kid, Al?
Well, does that count Playboy copies of Playboy magazine?
No, but I mean, so we're talking about kids, young kids, Al. So
I'm still a kid, Melody, at heart. You know, I still got that. I still have a certain amount of childish. You should have picked up on that by now.
They have 15,000 subscribers that can choose one or more sets from the company's online playlist. They ship the toys. The kit, when the kids tire of them, usually within 2 weeks, parents ship them back and they get a brand new set in return. The company just started out with 34 Lego sets purchased with some of $500,000 that they used for capital. Now they have 23 employees and they have about 50,000 sets. They charge up to $40 a month. And it's cheaper than buying the Lego sets, which can cost between $40 and $400. Now, get this. They've shipped, so far, they have shipped 80,000 sets. I mean, to me, these numbers are, I mean, it's like.
No, I know. Somebody came up with a brilliant idea. I don't know who thought of this. This is one of those ideas, if you had to go to the bank and say, I need to borrow money because I want to rent Lego sets to kids, see?
Yeah.
Who's going to lend money on that?
Yes. They raised $6.75 million in venture capital.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because these kids are so darn spoiled.
Well, they're spoiled, but you know something about
what's wrong with these parents?
Well, you know what this means?
They can't afford the toys.
No, it's not just that. It means that there's going to be space in the garage to actually park your car. Right now, most people have their garages stacked full of all the junk that they've bought for kids and themselves and Christmas presents and whatever. And we could set up a... we could probably a government-sponsored foundation who will move toys from house to house so you have a place to park your car. You don't ever have, instead of having 236 different toys or whatever it was, you may only have 5 or 6 toys at any given time, and you'll wait for the next shipment of toys to come in.
I mean, it's just another sign, I mean, of the times. And I remember getting one toy for Christmas, and all we got was socks and underwear for Christmas, you know, an orange in our stocking with some chocolate candy, maybe, and... to me, those were the best Christmases ever. But anyway,
well,
I just found that.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's. You were talking, though, what's wrong with the kids, but what's wrong with the toys? What's wrong with the toys? You know what really happens?
People can't afford them.
Well, we watch advertising on television, right? And the kids, the advertising is directed at the children. And you got kids that are screaming to have one of those dolls. I don't even remember what kind of dolls they had. Cabbage Patch dolls. Oh, I got to have a Cabbage Patch. Oh, you got to have a Cabbage Patch doll. Yeah, fine. Where is it now? I don't know. It's up in the attic or someplace. You know, they create, what advertising does is cause people to covet. Right? Bible says, thou shalt not covet. Advertising is designed to cause people to covet. I see a new car, and it's just, and there's a blonde there, and she's a good-looking woman. The rest of them say, "Oh my gosh, I want one of those new cars." It's designed to cause people to covet, and the problem when kids covet these things, like different toys, they get sold, and then they get them, and they begin to realize that the toy really didn't have much value. They don't yet understand that they were deceived by the advertising into coveting this toy. They don't get that yet, but the day will come when they do. But they do understand. They get the toy in the door, and they play with it for a couple of weeks, and they, this is a waste of time. I think people are going to begin, you know, this goes far enough, people are going to begin to understand a little bit better about what's worth having and what is irrelevant. And it's a little bit parallel to your story about you had socks, underwear, and an orange, and they were your best Christmases. You weren't coveting, per se, at that Christmas. You're just celebrating Christmas. You know, we could make that argument. And there's certainly a certain amount of covetousness in all of us, I guess. But in any case, 236 toys, and 230 of them are in the garage. We need to buy larger pieces of property so we can have a garage, a car garage, and a toy garage. See, there's the next invention, Melody. If this guy can do this, what we need to do is start selling toy garages to people. What do you think, Melody?
To say that people in this country don't have money when they have, you know, 238 toys for their kids, I don't know. Anyway, let's move on. That's enough of the toys. I just thought that was an interesting... I mean, look at the money that these people are making on something that is,
Toyland.
Anti-Chinese.
Profitable toy.
Let's talk about the Chinese who makes all those toys.
Well, they're not necessarily making the toys. We're talking about Chinese.
The majority.
Who are in Vietnam. Vietnam and China have always been adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
All right, they've come together. They came together to some degree during the Vietnam War, when Vietnam was facing the United States, of course. But by and large, there's a historical animosity between China and Vietnam, and it breaks out every so often. It's one of those areas. It's a little bit like the former Yugoslavia, where Tito was able to put a bunch of, I think, 8 competing provinces and join them into one coherent nation. 6 competing provinces. They've never really gotten along well down there. They haven't done it for centuries. There's always that lingering animosity, and it's waiting to explode. Same thing goes on over in Vietnam relative to China. This is an article from the New York Times entitled, Anti-Chinese Violence Convulses Vietnam, Pitting Laborers Against Laborers. While anti-Chinese violence in southern Vietnam earlier in the week targeted foreign factories, the outburst of anger here in the nation's center, that would be this week, took a more vindictive turn, with Vietnamese turning on Chinese laborers. Last week, they were burning factories. This week, they're the factories that were owned by Chinese individuals or foreigners in Vietnam. This week, they are going after Chinese laborers who are working perhaps in the Chinese-owned factories, perhaps in other factories, but they've had Chinese immigrants come into their country, and they're going after the laborers, and they're attacking them, and I think one person has died, and a number have been beaten up and injured and whatever. The violence in Ha Tinh, that would be a city in Vietnam, appeared to be the worst against Chinese since a territorial dispute inflamed anger in Vietnam. Some Vietnamese blame China and its decisions to send an oil rig to part of the South China Sea that Vietnamese considers theirs. Ships from both nations have reported being rammed, and photos have shown Chinese water cannons soaking Vietnam's ships. Pretty crazy stuff when you start ramming ships at sea. I mean, that's going to end badly. It either has to stop or it's going to end badly. And they continue ramming, and I guarantee somebody's going to sink, and you're going to find scores or more who die as a result. But the point of the story is China, who already has a problem with Japan, and I believe it's the Shikoku Islands, they're bumping heads with Japan over there. They are now prepared to bump heads with the Vietnamese in the South China Sea. And it appears that China is certainly beginning to exert itself locally and extend its power on a local basis. Now, that's interesting for a number of reasons, because it raises the possibility that we might see, who knows, China. We're always concerned about some sort of a conflict with China, but it may be that China's conflicts will be with Japan or maybe Vietnam. Maybe that's where this is going. It's also interesting because it illustrates that China, it suggests, that China is more concerned with expanding its power on a local basis in Asia than it is in expanding its power on a more foreign basis that would reach all the way into Europe or the United States. They're not out to get us, per se. They might be out to get the Japanese, they might be out to get the Vietnamese, but they're not out to get the Americans, at least not at this time. That's an argument. It's not necessarily true, but that's part of the suggestion. In any case, what we have is evidence of one more hot spot. You know, one more hot spot in the world where there would seem to be an increased possibility of violence. Frank, the producer, is doing violence to me right now by playing the music that will introduce our commercial announcements. We've got another hotspot for violence, and that's AmericanVoiceRadio.com. I'm Alfred Addis with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. We'll be right back.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. I have an article here from MarketWatch.com, which is a subsidiary of Wall Street Journal. And the headline is, America is being damaged by low rates, weak dollar. They mean low interest rates. And the sub-headline, opinion, no country has ever attained prosperity with a weak currency. Now, this is an interesting article because it brings up an interesting insight and probability. Let's read from the article a little bit. It says, 5 years after the beginning of the economic recovery, that by 5 years, that means the recovery allegedly began in 2009. So we've been in a state of recovery for the last 5 years. After rock-bottom interest rates and trillions of dollars of quantitative easing by the Federal Reserve, the economy is growing about 2% per year. That's what they claim. I'm not even sure the numbers are accurate, but that's what they're claiming. No country has attained prosperity by printing money and weakening its currency. And the United States appears to be no different. Monetary stimulus might be useful in the initial stages of a recession and recovery, but 0% interest rates for years on end are a different matter altogether. Under Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and his successor Janet Yellen, the dollar has fallen about 15% against the euro. What they mean is that as compared to the euro, the dollar has lost about 15% of its purchasing power over, well, how long was that? Would be over a period of, I think Bernanke was there
six
for
months.
What? How long was Bernanke? No, how long was Bernanke there? At least 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're talking 6, maybe 7 years, the dollar's fallen about 15% against the euro. But the euro's value is also falling, its purchasing power. So we're measuring a falling dollar against a falling euro. And that measurement has to understate the dollar's actual loss in purchasing power over the last 6 or 7 years. If we compare the price of gold in 2008, when it was about $800 an ounce, to the price of gold today at $1,300 an ounce, we see that the dollar lost about 62% of its value compared to gold. It may have lost 15% against the euro, but it lost 62% of its value as compared to gold over the course of the last 6, 8 years. So, you know, when you make these comparisons, what is the true, how much purchasing power has the dollar really lost? 15% compared to the euro, 60% compared to gold. What is the real loss in purchasing power of the dollar? It's certainly more than 15%. I won't say that it's across the board 62%, but it's certainly much more than 15% that they talk about in this article. The article continues. It says, according to Columbia University professor Charles Calamaris, co-author of Fragile by Design, The Political Origins of the Banking Crisis, if the Fed expands its balance sheet by buying bonds from banks, but those banks simply increase their reserves at the Fed and fail to increase loans and deposits on their balance sheets, then monetary policy has little effect through the traditional channels of expanding deposits and loans. In other words, if the local bank goes up and sells a bond, or one of the big banks, they sell some bonds to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve gives them cash. In theory, that cash should be used to lend money to you, me, and Melody. All right? And if we have money to borrow, and we do borrow, and we go out and borrow that money, that stimulates the economy, because I'm going to borrow money to buy a new car, and Melody's going to buy money to redecorate her kitchen or something like that, and you folks have a project for that, and it will stimulate the economy. But if the banks sell bonds to the Federal Reserve and they take the cash and keep it essentially for themselves, they don't bother to lend it out, then there's no economic stimulus. And that's what's basically happened over the past several years with the loans from the Fed to the banks, and then the banks don't bother to send it out to the great unwashed, that's you, me, and well, all of us. Even worse, the article continues, if the Fed fails to remove liquidity fast enough once the expansion takes hold, then aggressive monetary policy can spark inflation, which slows economic growth. What they're saying is the purpose of quantitative easing and injecting all of this cash, they give it to the banks on the presumption the banks will lend it to the people. If it does, if it is loaned to the people, it will increase the money supply. It will cause inflation as the dollar becomes worth less and less. Now, what they're saying is that once inflation catches hold, it's hard to stop. It takes on a life of its own. It hasn't really started to a significant degree yet. But it could. The policy of injecting $85 billion a month, and now they've tapered that down towards $45 billion a month now, and quantitative easing 1 and 2, these policies should contribute to inflation significantly, but it hasn't happened yet. However, the article continues and says this may already be happening. The Bureau of Labor Statistics said Wednesday that when the producer price index jumped by 0.6% in April, well above expectation of 0.2%, this may already be happening. Bureau of Labor Statistics said Wednesday that the producer price index jumped by 0.6%, well above expectations of 0.2%. Core producer price index, which excludes food and energy, rose 0.5%. Over the past year, the price of food has risen by 2.7%, and inflation often starts with increases in food prices. Now, whoever wrote this article for the Wall Street Journal, ultimately for the Wall Street Journal, no one is going to convince me that the price of food has risen by 2.7% in the past year. You might be able to convince me that it rose by 2.7% in the last month, but not in the last year. I buy groceries. I go to the store every once in a while, and I mean, I can see changes in prices I can see them on a monthly or even biweekly basis. I wanted to get some limes the other day. They were $1 a piece for limes. I guarantee the price of food is rising more rapidly than 2.7% per year. Article continues. Rise in producer prices takes a few months to work their way into consumer prices, but the consumer price index released Thursday showed the cost of living in April rising at its fastest rate in 10 months. The 0.3% increase brings the year-over-year advance to 2%. Well, we are 2% higher than we were last year, and we're only 6 months and not even 5 months into this year. It implies they're going to admit to 4 or 5% inflation by the end of this year. That's the implication. Talk about unemployment, and it's another number that indicates that on the face of it, you would think the economy is doing better, but the article compares unemployment rates in previous recessions to what we see this time, and they say we're not doing anywhere near as well as we have in the past. And they say this time unemployment has not returned to pre-crash levels. The unemployment rate is 6.3%, 1% higher than the average rate at this point in the previous four recessions. But the only reason the unemployment rate has declined to 6.3% is because the labor force participation rate has fallen to 1978 levels. After recoveries are underway, they go on and explain that more people go to work, but in this case, that's not the case. Labor force participation has dropped from 65.7% of June of 2009 to 62.8% today. This is particularly pronounced. They go through a series of other indicators that the recovery is not working, that the policy of low interest rates and a weak dollar is not serving the nation well. Talk about food stamps. And they get down, they say the Fed took a different path than it has in the past. Between February 94 and February 95, the Fed increased interest rates. This is during a recession. 94 to 95, they increased interest rates from 3% to 6%. We have lowered interest rates down to where they're nearly 0%. And from 94 to 95, they ended that recession by increasing interest rates from 3% to 6%, and thereby strengthening the dollar. Now, bear in mind that the title of this article is America is being damaged by low rates and weak dollars. And we're going to look and see, we're going to get to a point here where we try to explain why we are being damaged. When we talk about historically, the author, the article talks about historically, they raised interest rates during a recession, and at least at the end of a recession, and thereby strengthened the dollar and helped make the country go. Now, I've warned people for several years that by reducing interest rates, which is what the Federal Reserve has done now, the Federal Reserve, number one, reduced the bank's incentive to lend to consumers. Why should I lend money? Assuming I was a bank, why should I lend money to consumers if I can only get 2 or 3% return on my investment? When you factor in inflation and the risk, the truth of the matter is I'm losing money on the transaction. When they lower the interest rates, the bank's incentive to lend is diminished. Right? And number two, by reducing the interest rates, they increased the Fed increased the lender's incentive to send their capital from this country to invest it in foreign countries that paid higher rates of interest. And the result, Americans now enjoy spectacularly low interest rates, but we have less access to capital. The capital has been driven out of the country to some degree by low interest rates. If I've got $100,000 to lend, do you think I want to lend it for 1.5%, or do you think I want to lend it for 10%? If I have to send my $100,000 to Uganda or Uruguay or some other, or France, to get 10%, as opposed to getting 1.5% here in the United States, or even 3%, what do you think I'm going to do? I'm going to move my capital overseas. And in doing so, there's less money, so it lowers the money supply in this country, and hurts our economy. So if, as the headline suggests, America is being damaged by low rates and weak dollars, why do we have economic policies conducive to this national damage? And the answer, I believe, is because those policies, while harmful to the American people, harmful to you and me and Melody and the people across the street and down the block and the community next to community down the road and so on, we're being damaged by these policies. But we have them anyway. Why? Because the policies are beneficial to our government. First, thanks to low interest rates, government can borrow more money to allegedly stimulate the economy without significant interest costs. All right? When you can borrow for free, borrow it. No big deal. It didn't cost you anything. Second, thanks to the falling value of fiat dollars. All right? They said they were declining by 15% compared to euros and 62% compared to gold. The U.S. government could repay some of its overwhelming national debt with cheaper dollars. What's the implication of all this? The implication is that the U.S. economy is being run for the benefit of the government and those special interests deemed too big to fail, rather than for the benefit of the American people. The people are being intentionally robbed, intentionally impoverished, while the government is being enriched and empowered. The current economic policy of low interest rates and a weak dollar is ideal for building a police state. The people grow weaker and are increasingly impoverished, while the government's powers and even wealth are, certainly powers, I won't argue wealth right now, but they're expanded. And you can even argue that the government's wealth is expanded because by reducing the actual value of the national debt, we don't have to pay as much. We still pay the same number of dollars, but they don't have the same purchasing power as they did 5 or 10 years ago. So the government's getting over, and the point is you and I are paying a price. And why? Because the government believes that the most important thing in America is the government. We don't need children. If we can't afford children, no one cares. If we can't afford entrepreneurs, no one cares. But we can't get by without government. That's the government's perspective. And this article implies that they are running the economy for their benefit rather than ours. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom on Financial Survival. We'll be back on Monday. Hope you all have a good weekend. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.